Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. We have another special guest this week in Matt Barry. Matt is an award-winning entrepreneur, technologist and lecturer, having won numerous awards, including being named the inaugural BRW Entrepreneur of the Year in 2011. He is now the founder and CEO of listed company Freelancer.com, which is one of the world's largest freelancing and crowdsourcing marketplaces. In today's interview, we discuss Matt's views on the Australian economy's house of cards, how we got into this situation, and some critical areas we need to address to help us get out of it. Through Freelancer.com's global reach, Matt also sits in the perfect position to provide some serious insight into current macroeconomic themes and some issues that confront emerging technology businesses in Australia today. After the interview, we'll then look at some of the wider investment implications that these themes can impact on how we invest money every day at Nucleus Wealth. So join Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen, Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith, and myself, Tim Fuller, as we dive into a fascinating hour with one of Australia's thought leaders of the new age. I hope you enjoy. So today on the podcast, we're very fortunate to have on the show award-winning entrepreneur, technologist and lecturer, and is currently kept very busy as the CEO of Freelancer.com, Matt Barry. Welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Matt, a big part of why we're excited to get you on the show today stems from a terrific piece you co-authored in late 2017 entitled House of Cards. And I think I would be correct in saying that popular media loves to focus on thought bubbles of successful and well-known people such as yourself. But what really struck a chord with us was that the House of Cards was anything but a thought bubble. So you covered off on themes such as world trade, quantitative easing, global monetary policy, government policy, the housing bubble, immigration, and our dire need to address innovation. So I thought I might just start off by asking you what drove you to put together this essentially tome of research and opinion back in 2017?
Well, I guess coming from the perspective of the technology industry, I and many others in the industry have been continually frustrated by Australia's failure to really embrace the future, embrace technology, and really drive the economy forward. And, you know, I've written in the past about technology policy, about various different angles and aspects, but it wasn't really until I started trying to address the fundamental issues that are facing Australia as a country and the economy as a whole that everything started really coming together about why we can't move forward as a country and why that we are slowly sort of devolving into a developing world economy.
Okay, sure.
And so, Matt, you know, I like to, you know, I like to sort of, I guess, pigeonhole the average Australian investor as somebody who wants to then actually go and, you know, I want to go buy a house somewhere and do it up and then sell it to somebody, or I want to go stick some money in a mine and make some money from it from that perspective, which is very different, obviously, to the person who wants to start a technology company in the garage. Australians seem to be very focused on that whole property wealth thing. You know, do you think we need a decent sized housing crash just to shake that from our psyche, from our national psyche?
Well, I mean, if we step back and just look at the economy as a whole and kind of what do we do in this country? What industries do we have? What do we produce? You know, where is Australia placed in terms of, you know, the global economy and the future? I mean, we've got a very, very, very primitive economy. You know, on one level, we ship iron ore overseas to China. You know, we're the largest exporter of iron ore in the world. It's about 30% of market share by volume and 50% by value, and 80% of that goes to China. And you know, in China, they consume it. Half of that iron ore goes to into property, and they're going through various booms and busts of property speculation. You know, right now, iron ore is going pretty well for us, probably mainly because there's a supply disruption out of Brazil with Vale. But you know, really, we just dig dirt out of the ground and we ship overseas. You know, the second biggest thing that we export is coal, and we do that to China and Japan. I mean, Japan's a temporary blip because of Fukushima and the nuclear reactors temporarily going offline. But you know, that's all starting to come back online. And you know, naturally, Japan usage of electricity is waning because the population is aging and actually declining and shrinking in Japan. So net electricity generation is declining. China says that with coal that they want to match domestic demand with domestic supply and stop importing coal at some point. In fact, a few weeks ago, we had a bit of a scare in Australia where the Port of Dalian said that they will no longer accept Australian coal. And you know, a few days later, they said it was a misunderstanding. But you know, the writing is in the wall, particularly for thermal coal, which is the coal that we use to burn for electricity. I mean, the UK had its first day burning coal. So the first day generating electricity without burning coal since the Industrial Revolution a couple of years ago. And then we've got coal that was used for steel generation, steel manufacturing, which is nearly tied to, from our perspective, the Chinese property market, which kind of oscillates. Then the third biggest thing we do in this country is we do education-related travel services. I had no idea what that was, and I had to kind of look into it. And it's basically immigration dressed up as education. And this is why we've got all those English colleges in the city and IT colleges that, you know, producing graduates of the course that no one really in the IT industry would really, really hire. They're really just colleges designed to kind of skirt through the immigration rules and get people into the country, because the federal government likes to import people as a form of, I guess, quantitative easing by growing the population by 11,000 or 12,000 people a month. They kind of drive a bit of demand and pay some taxes and so forth. But outside of that, we do very, very little. We used to be the 10th largest car manufacturer in the world, and we shut down the last plant, I think it was about a year ago, for car manufacturing. I think it's only about, manufacturing is about 6.6%, I think, of gross value add in the country. We do very, very, very little. In some industries like textiles, in 1 year we can lose 33% of all jobs, like we did in textiles about 2 years ago. In fact, this month, the last Huggies plant shut down and it's going to Asia. Now, the manufacturing we're doing needs to be a lot more sophisticated and a lot more high-end and more value-add, so we can pay for the expensive wages that we have here. But effectively, we do very little in this country. And so what does the government do in terms of response to deal with the fact that we don't really produce anything? We've got a very unsophisticated economy, and that blow a big housing bubble. And so, over the last decade, probably the mother of all bubbles has been blown, which is a housing bubble on top of a China bubble on top of a commodities bubble, and that housing bubble is now popping. And the scale at which we've blown this bubble, I mean, according to a thing called the Ryder-Levitt-Bucknell Crane Index, there were 735 cranes operating in the last quarter reported in Australia, about 80% of them producing residential apartments, and about 350 of them in Sydney. And to put that in context, in the top 14 North American markets combined, there's only about 175 cranes, right? And that's in 14 markets. And this is a country with a population much, much, much larger than Australia. So, we've been blowing this big housing bubble to create this false sense of wealth, but in actual fact, we've also been growing a massive debt bubble with households, and that bubble is now popping. And so we are in terrible strife to this point.
Can I ask you, Matt? It's David here. Undoubtedly, you're right about the sort of pro-cyclical nature of government policy in terms of that hollowing out that you're describing. And we might, traditionally that sort of thing's been called Dutch disease. I think we can safely say that we've gone to something much more fatal and call it Australian disease. But I'm just wondering, have you actually had personal experience of how that might work in the market as well? Like, for instance, various economists have, over the years have posited that it's difficult for areas that aren't part of the resource endowment to attract capital and staff, etc. And so these are kind of market dimensions that government policy should be, leaning against instead of, putting a tailwind behind. Have you actually come across that in your various sort of entrepreneurial pursuits?
I have, from various angles, from a financing perspective, the good thing about having a technology company in Australia is you're a company that is in high demand from investors because there's not much to invest in, right? I mean, if you look at the ASX, you know, it is a very, very large equity capital market. It's the same size as NASDAQ, which is, you know, the fourth largest equity capital market in the world, but it's all in resources. And outside of resources, there's very little to invest in. There's not much in the way.
And banks.
This is the perverse thing about the Australian stock market is that the banks plus Macquarie are about 30% of the ASX 200. And the perverse thing that's happening that continues to blow the property bubble is that every month, 9.5% of the Australian wage bill flows into superannuation. Of that superannuation, I think it's about 28% flows into equities, of which 30% in the ASX 200 are the bank stocks. So every month you're kind of like pumping the bank equity, which allows them to kind of, you know, have larger balance sheets and so forth. And then of that superannuation, about 14% goes into residential property. So, but if you've got a technology company and you list it on the ASX, you can get a great multiple. In fact, some of the multiples in the ASX over the last couple of years have been pretty extreme and probably on par or even superseding the sort of valuations you get in Silicon Valley. And that's great from the perspective of the fact that when you're listed, you have a very flat share structure. You don't have this convoluted layers of preferred stock, Series A, Series B, Series C, because a lot of the valuations in technology have been manufactured in the Valley through liquidation preference and ratchets and other contractual mechanisms for generating these high valuations, which haven't been real. But in Australia, you've actually managed to generate them with an ordering structure. So it's actually been quite beneficial from that perspective. The negative thing about running a technology company here in Australia is that you can't find people with experience who've got sort of 10 years in technology. If you're a serious technologist, after about 10 years, you kind of go to Silicon Valley. You go work at Google or Facebook or somewhere over there where you've got the deep expertise and you can actually learn and go to the next level. In Australia, it kind of caps out after a few years. You know, the expertise is not really here. It all goes, or they start their own company. And the other thing is that in some areas, some of the job functions are very, very hard to hire, and the costs escalate quite rapidly. So, for example, in computer science, you're seeing now grads 2-3 years, et cetera, sometimes getting their salaries double and so forth, which becomes a real problem in terms of trying to build a technology base here.
So, sorry, Matt. Like one of the things we sort of run from an investment perspective is that, you know, when the Australian dollar has sort of hit parity with the US dollar, it was very hard for any company that was international to justify sticking another employee in Australia, just because you'd say, well, for the same prices, I can hire somebody in Australia, I can hire somebody in the US or even Europe or the UK, you know, on a cheaper basis. We've Aussie dollar's obviously fallen back to sort of closer to 70 cents now. From your perspective, is it starting to get to the point where it sounds as if it's still more expensive to buy somebody in Australia at a senior level than what you'd find elsewhere? Or is that is there a price issue as well as a talent issue still at the current exchange rates? Do we need to see those fall further, I guess, before Australian employees become more attractive?
It depends on what job function you're talking about. So I have offices in 7 countries around the world. So I have offices in London, Vancouver, San Francisco, right at the heart of the valley, Manila, at Buenos Aires, and Jakarta. And what I find is, that particularly in computer science, software engineering, the wages are getting out of control. And when I say out of control, I mean literally you can see them double in space of 2 or 3 years after graduation. However, the Valley has just gone crazy. Like to try and hire someone in the Valley now, it is just almost impossible. The average salary for just an American in any job function in San Francisco is $87,000. But when you start getting into software development, you can be paying $250,000, $300,000, $400,000 for, you know, mid-level person fully loaded. But more of a problem is that in the Valley, people just don't really want to work because the demand is so high. You know, everyone we hire in the San Francisco office tells me, oh, can I work from home 2 days a week, 3 days a week, 4 days a week? You know, if they have a chiropractor appointment, they take the whole day off. You know, and at 5 o'clock, they want to go home. So it's certainly a better environment than Silicon Valley, which has just gone stupid. But if you go somewhere like London, I mean, the rents are very expensive in London, but the salaries are much less. So you can hire a grad for about 60% of the price that you would pay for a software engineer in Australia on a dollar-for-dollar basis. And the senior salaries top out pretty early in London. So there are, and then of course we have about 100, 200 engineers in Manila where it's significantly cheaper, but we have done a cost benefit analysis on that in terms of productivity, and we do find the productivity is a bit lower there, but if we get that productivity up, it's obviously a massive, massive powerhouse and advantage.
So why do you base yourself here?
Well, it's a good question. If I had a choice about doing it all again, I probably wouldn't. My last company was headquartered in Silicon Valley in Palo Alto. And, I made a decision back in 2000 to move back after I graduated and had worked for a couple of years in the Valley because of quality of life. But now, a lot of the regulations and all that's come in, particularly at the state level in New South Wales, I would change my mind, as well as all the issues you have running a tech company. So now where would I probably start a company today if I had a chance to do it all over again? I'd probably think about doing it in London.
Okay. And Matt, actually, just going back to speaking around the inflated sort of prices you're paying, it sounds like on the West Coast in the US, actually reminds me a bit of my engineering time during the mining boom when, people would empty the bins in the huts were jumping jobs for $20,000 pay rises and going from $120 to $140. That speaks to me like there is, is it just a scarcity thing that you just can't find good people and you just got to pay overs every time?
That's exactly it. And the tenure in the Valley, I mean, I have a friend who's actually dating someone that one of the tech startups there. And he said the average tenure is 6 months. And when you bring someone on and you train them up, it takes a month or two to train up, and then 4 months later they're gone. I mean, how do you run a company? It's impossible. So it is a supply issue. And the supply issue is also acute in Australia as well, but only in specific areas. So the interesting thing is it's really highly concentrated in software engineering. It's not so hard to find designers. There's also a lot of people coming from overseas to Australia to do design. Data sciences is usually fairly straightforward because if you have a degree in any of the sciences, either you're going to work in a government facility or become an academic or work in finance, or you go into data science and technology. So it is not so hard to find data scientists who are very, very, very high quality for a reasonable amount. But it's in certain areas, particularly acute also in DevOps, which is a part of software revolving around managing systems, so cloud computing, because there's obviously this explosion with Google and Amazon and everything moving to AWS and so forth. And in that particular area, the system administrators, who actually used to be the lower ranked engineers on the food chain, are actually now commanding very, very high salaries.
Well, I mean, that was my anecdote from innovation side, and that was where sort of stretching into yours as well. That I started a company in 1999-2000, and the office we were in, the server rooms couldn't handle the machines, and so we had portable air conditioners, and somebody had to go in and set them up and empty the water on the weekend, and I had to take backup tapes home every few days. We needed the DBA and all these system administrators and multiple machines and all that, and so we probably spent at least 150, probably 200 a year on that, and I think I'm doing the same plus more on AWS for maybe 100th the cost, yeah. Possibly less. Yeah, just crazy in terms of that. So from that perspective, you'd sort of think that innovation has got this whole, and it seems in the US there's that whole attitude now, set it up in your garage and off you go. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be an attitude in the average Australian graduate, I suppose.
Well, I mean, the graduates we produce are actually quite good. It's just the issue is they're not very many of them. I mean, I just went to the National Computer Science School's lunch because I'm one of the platinum sponsors for this. And, they were crowing about how they produce 130 graduates per year. That are really school kids that are going into university. So it's kind of like an intermediary step to get the elite of the elite out of school system into tertiary education and computer science. And, I was in the room with, Atlassian and the Australian Signals Directorate and WiseTech and a bunch of other tech companies that sponsor it. And we walked out and I turned to Atlassian and said, what's your graduate intake this year? And they said 160. So, and the school was like 130. It's a national program. It's like, so, It's just not at the right scale, anywhere near the right scale. And like, if you look at,
a private market opportunity, isn't it? Well, I mean, where's the market failure there? Like,
well, the market failure is in the primary school system, and so the secondary school system, which in particular year 7 to year 10, because if you ask any kid, would you like to work on the next Facebook, SpaceX, you know, Google Glasses, you know, self-driving cars? Every kid can put his hand up or her hand up and say, yeah, absolutely love to do that. But they can't connect the dots between what they taught in school and a career. You know, when I graduated in 1990 from high school, I went to a private school in Sydney. You know, I thought that engineering had something to do with driving trains. I hadn't even been introduced to the word engineer. I went back and I did careers fair not so long ago at that school. And again, the kids just still thought engineering was something to do with driving trains. They just can't connect the dots. The curriculum hasn't really changed in a very, very, very long time. For the most part, there is some stuff around the edges. You know, the IT, you know, or the computer science teacher at high school reports to the woodwork teacher. It's more of a trade than it is a science. You know, mathematics in schools has declined, and so forth. And in the enrollment in CompSci, you know, it's really in the long term trend been declining quite. A lot in the last decade or more, actually. In fact, and this is kind of universally around the world. I mean, it wasn't really since the Viking landing on Mars and the moon landing that you know, since then enrollments in so the hard sciences has been declining, or even in the US. Although there's been an uptick in the last number of years in computer science, specifically since the Social Network came out, which is the Facebook movie.
Okay. And so I guess what jumps to mind here, though, and you mentioned there that it all sort of starts at the primary school system, so it sort of lends itself to it almost certainly needs a political response, would you say? Is this sort of something that you think would help correct that in the longer term? It is a longer term play, though, probably much longer than your average politician term. So,
well, we have big failings in the, I think, political system in Australia. The first is we need to really have a national narrative that we need to make it an imperative to build a technology and advanced manufacturing focused economy. And we really need to change the economy from a very simple one of digging up dirt, literally, and shipping overseas, and immigration to try and pump up a failing economy and blowing a housing bubble. We need to be producing, creating industries that are productivity and wealth multipliers because we have a relatively small number of people in this country. And, you know, to do that, it really is a multi-level thing. I mean, the government has to be talking about this and more than just, you know, an innovation statement or jobs and growth or a throwaway line, which isn't even in the narrative. It isn't even in the narrative nowadays with the politicians. I mean, that was kind of that was blamed for Malcolm Turnbull's you know, demise. It needs to be with, you know, with the school system, but the problem is the school system is just tied up with bureaucracy. We produce actually too many school teachers at these levels. In fact, not every school teacher coming out of teachers' college can actually get a place, and so the ones that have actually got places are desperately trying to hold on to their positions, and they don't want to modernize the curriculum because they'll feel threatened by the new teachers that are coming out of the system. And then parents, you know, the way we set up the whole tertiary educational system to get into the tertiary education system, you've got like this leaderboard, which comes out of the secondary school system, like the high school certificate you know, the various, you know, state-by-state models for that. And you get a score, and that score tells you that the top of the rank is you can become a doctor or a lawyer. And God knows we don't need any more lawyers. And they are having problems placing all the doctors that are coming out of university to get their residency. So, but there's no discussion anywhere on the spectrum about you know, engineering or science or technology. And really, the great thing about these industries that create the future, that create businesses, that create industries. And you know, I can't think of industry in the world where a 20-year-old can kind of come out and, you know, a decade later have created one of the biggest companies in the world, which being Facebook or being Google or.
Sorry, do you think there's a part to play in industry then and corporates such as yourself who are very successful, have found a good niche in the market in helping to provide some colour around that narrative? I'm just putting it out there, I guess, because it doesn't feel like the government's going to do a lot. So go to the other side. But is there sort of something in that, particularly perhaps in Australia where, you know, look, for those that are in technology, know the Atlassian fellows, know yourself, Outside of that, though, you know, if you speak to someone in the street, they, you know, they'd probably name, you know, perhaps one or two US tech entrepreneurs, but, you know, sort of it falls short there. Is that sort of something? Because I'm just thinking, in a sense, the parents are the ones that perhaps are guiding the kids into, you know, into a sort of vocation or a direction as well at home.
I mean, certainly, and industry here has been doing things for some time. You know, it's just that the scale that our industry exists in this country is really quite small and sub-economic in many ways. So, you know, there's limited things that a company of my size can do. You know, obviously, Atlassian's a bit bigger, and there's a few other companies, et cetera, out there. And, you know, Richard White from WiseTech is doing a lot. He's funding everything he can to do with educational programs for computer science. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's only a small drop in the ocean compared to what needs to happen at a national scale.
And it also sounds so as well, if you've got second thoughts as to whether you'd start a company in Australia as well, there's obviously, you know, if the existing players are still can't work out a reason to be here, then it sounds as if there's certainly some significant structural changes that would need to be made.
Sure, and we need to do more than, it's more than just sort of STEM. I mean, there's things like building up good trade schools around, you know, to bring, you know, manufacturing back to the country. And if we're going to bring manufacturing back to the country, we need to do it in a way where we can deal with the fact that we have very, very high wages. So we've got to do advanced manufacturing, we've got to, you know, robotics or whatever it may be. And I think we've got to really strengthen the trade schools and to build that sort of bring that base back, as opposed to kind of very low skilled and low value add manufacturing like nappies. And of course, if we produce nappies, of course they're going to go overseas because people, to countries with low wages.
Matt, are you a fan of the sort of hub approach where some cities and governments around the world, well, many in fact, have tried to create technology hubs through providing various infrastructure?
I don't believe in it from a perspective of let's build a building, which seems to be a lot of the approach. Let's build a precinct and kind of put people in the precinct.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to me. Well, what does make sense is picking industries where we want to be world leaders. You know, China does this. You know, China gets up and says, you know, their version of the budget, they get up and say, here are the five critical areas we want to lead the world in, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, quantum, you know, this, that, the other. In Australia, we don't do that. We just kind of discuss what transfer payments we're going to make back to the populace. Here, have some of your own money back that you paid in taxes, and, you know, you can pretend we're doing something for you, right? You know, we should think about, you know, for example, mining technology. You know, we could be a world leader in mining technology. That's an area we could probably build some expertise. You know, we have an environment where we could do, you know, really well for solar powered and other form of renewables. You know, with all the desert we have and all the sunshine that hits it, there's probably something we can do there.
Well, I mean, we did have terrific leadership in solar in the 80s and 90s, especially at UNSW. Well, I mean, it was so thoroughly ignored and disparaged by the Howard government of the day that they ended up selling most of the IP to the Germans and Chinese.
That's right.
Who developed it and sold it back to us. But I mean, that raises an interesting question as well. You know, obviously we're in a bit of a context now of almost technological warfare, this sort of developing Cold War 2.0 and wild allegations from, you know, all fronts on stolen technology and sort of embedded espionage and what have you,
yeah.
Especially around China. Does China impact you in any way that's, you know, good or bad?
Look, I think everyone has to be naive to think that to think that all governments didn't involve themselves in this sort of thing. I think it's kind of what the, you know, getting an edge in trade, I'm pretty sure that's kind of a remit of a lot of departments in a lot of different countries, governments. Look, in terms of China, I think the issue with China is it's kind of hard to operate there as a technology company, being an internet company, because you need special licensing and so forth. You know, I'd like to think that, you know, generally across many countries of the world, my company is very well received because we bring opportunity and income through, you know, providing jobs in technical areas to people around the world. So I generally like to think that we're well received. And, you know, in places like Malaysia, for example, the Malaysian government through their MDEC program, which is the Development Corporation, actually goes and educates people in rural communities on how to use my website. in order, because they believe that to get the bottom 20% socioeconomically fully productive, being people, you've got to give them micro work in the cloud. So, 2 days a week, part-time work, whatever it may be, job by job, whether it's in remote locations or whether someone's aged or whether someone's disabled or whatever it may be. China's a massive market, but the problem is to try and compete as a technology company in that market, being external is difficult. I mean, Donald Trump's trying to negotiate as part of the free trade agreement that they're working on with the US, the ability for a US company to own 100% of the equity of a Chinese subsidiary. We'll see kind of where that goes. No, we don't, although we do have US customers that operate in China that want us to operate in China as part of some partnership work we're doing with them, and we're going to have to try and figure this out in some way.
I guess that's where David was possibly leaving with some of those questions. So, what of our sort of fundamental views on a in terms of where we've been buying stocks is looking upon this as being that I think there wouldn't be too many banks or people with or government agencies who would have happily bought servers from, say, Russia over the last 10, 15 years and installed them on their machines and not thought twice about it, whereas we sort of feel as if that's very much been the case for China, that people have just, buy a server or buy components or whatever, and if they happen to be Chinese, they happen to be Chinese. Given the spate of spy chips and accusations and hacking and all that type of stuff like that, I guess we're taking the view that going forward it will be an issue for companies and they will need to say, well, If I'm a chief technology officer of a bank, should I buy servers that were only made in China, or should I maybe spend another 20% and get something from somewhere else? Is that something that I guess you're seeing flowing through, or do you think we're off the mark on that thought?
I think a little bit off the mark. I mean, China's been the great 3D printer for America. I mean, like you send everything to China to get it made, and that's why the US economy has kind of grown so well, because you can get things done very, very, very cheaply. You can take that technology and you can kind of build businesses with it. Now, of course, the US is now seeing that as a threat and saying, well, wow, we're kind of at a point now where, if we don't do something about this, potentially, our hegemony can be threatened by a new world power, because it has been a fairly unipolar world in the last decade or so. But at the end of the day, China is a phenomenal resource for actually getting things manufactured and made. It's unsurpassed in many areas in terms of the expertise and the skills. I mean, people used to go there for cheap labor. You don't go there so much for cheap labor anymore. You go there for the expertise and the skills and the supply chains they've set up. I mean, there was comments about Trump was trying to get Tim Cook to kind of produce the iPhone back in America again. The problem is that, even to kind of to assemble the phone and get the screws to put in the phone, they didn't have the supply chain to be able to actually go and source the screws. Everything's been moved to China. So maybe from a strategic perspective, it's been a mistake, and this is why letting the manufacturing side of Australia fall apart has been a bit of a mistake. But it is what it is. If you kind of want to avoid that and not have a disadvantage by having to pay a premium to use technologies that are sourced elsewhere, you need to do something about building the manufacturing side of your economy back up again.
So how would you go about, like, we kind of discussed tech and the contest with China, but I mean, for manufacturers, it's even more kind of critical, isn't it? When I remember talking to a quite innovative firm, I think he was doing some kind of building products, but quite sophisticated stuff, and he said he had about 60 days before his Chinese competitors were producing or reproducing his new product at half the price. So I mean, how do you go about kind of rebuilding your manufacturing sector when you're confronted with such a ruthless and competitive environment?
Well, when you're in business, you kind of just have to out-execute. I mean, like if you run a website like mine, someone can throw up a website that operates like Freelancer, like even easier than you can manufacture a product. I mean, a website is just a website. Anyone can write some software and kind of copy everything you've done. You just have to out-execute them in terms of in terms of your performance, right? You've got to figure out a smarter way to kind of do things and just bear in mind that anyone can kind of copy your website. And that literally happens. Like, you know, like look at Facebook and Snapchat. Snapchat comes out with a feature. Next thing, Facebook just copies it, right? Instagram copies it, right? So you've just got to execute better and just you know, acknowledge the competition is getting pretty extreme. But in terms of how would you rebuild manufacturing, I think, you know, you're just going to have to probably deal with the fact that in Australia that wages are going to be very, very, very high. As a result of that, we have to be producing goods that are higher up the value chain. You know, we have to elaborately transform the things that we dig out of the ground, and rather than ship the raw materials, we have to find a way to kind of add value, economic value to them. We're going to do that with technology. We're going to do that with advanced manufacturing techniques. We're going to do that with like robotics. I think we need to build the skills up in the country around this, and not just at the university level, but I do think at the trade school level. I mean, one thing about America, when you go to America and you see people working in the, you know, machine shops and working on, you know, even those shows on TV, they show you like taking cars, classic cars, and you know, renovating them and so forth, right? The skills just seem to be at a completely different level from what we have in this country. And so I think,
well, I mean, the US manufacturing sector is roughly the size of the Australian economy.
There you go.
So it's got some critical mass for it to work with.
I think that the one of the ways, I mean, there are massive problems with the political system, and I can talk about it in a second, but that aside, I think one of the ways you can, I think, fairly rapidly change industry, the economy, and so forth is through education. Education is the lubricant for upwards mobility. And, you know, you put someone through an engineering degree or a trade school, and 4 years later, they pop out the other side and they will go into the industry, you know, in more advanced jobs with higher paying wages and ultimately pay more taxes because they'll be in higher paid jobs. Or they'll start businesses and generate value in that way. And so I think what I would do is you've got to find some way to fix the late secondary school system so that kids can see the career path from, you know, particularly before year 10, because by year 11 and 12, they're kind of picking subjects for the HSC, and then kind of that's it. You need to find a way to get that path going, and then you probably need to provide some incentives in the educational system, both the university and the trade schools, for people to go into some select areas, which are areas which will be great productivity and wealth multipliers for the country. So in parts of engineering, parts of trade schools, maybe we should be providing free education again, instead of stripping the universities of funding and forcing them to become really degree mills for students. Or the immigration system, which is kind of what it become. I mean, I've seen, for example, the University of Sydney. I mean, when I went through 91, 92, 93, 94, 96, the lecturers there wrote the textbooks that I used at Stanford University when I did my grad school. So Ross Quinlan, for example, wrote the textbook in artificial intelligence that I used at Stanford University. Neil Westy, who went on to develop Radiata, which did the Wi-Fi chips, he wrote the textbook that I used in Stanford for VLSI design. Right. And that's changed a lot. The universities now focus more on teaching how to use Microsoft Office because it's more lucrative for them than they do with the advanced skills. No kidding. Sydney University makes more money off the office courses than they do off anything else. And in fact, for the advanced technology courses, they can't teach them because they only have, you know, they try and teach an advanced power systems course and only 8 students will enroll. So I've told the universities they need to go to an online model and rather than spending, you know, $20 million in a building, spend $20 million on a website. And instead of having 8 students in a course in an in the physical world, you can have 8,000 by going into the world and just having these sort of deep silos of expertise where, you know, you teach very specific subjects, but you teach them to the world.
Do you find, because you do a fair bit of lecturing yourself, don't you? Is that right?
I stopped after 14 years out of frustration.
And what the frustration was, just this decline in pedagogical standards, or?
I taught 2 subjects. I taught cryptography or computer security, and I taught technology entrepreneurship. And these are fairly multidisciplinary courses. And what I would find was I taught out of the engineering faculty, the electrical engineering school in particular. And even though the science students would have the same subjects, they could get credit only if they're enrolled in electrical engineering. So I could teach entrepreneurship, but I could only teach it to electrical engineers. I couldn't teach it to mechanical engineers. I couldn't teach it to aerospace. I couldn't teach it to business students. I couldn't teach it to medicine, and I couldn't teach it to science students. And so I'd have all these people in my class attending, and I'd bring out these amazing lecturers to guest lecture. I had like the head of data science from Amazon, and you know, everyone coming to the class. And the classroom would be full, but the number of students could actually take it for credit was very, very, very small. And after 14 years of this and saying, this is completely ridiculous, you need to have a way in which people can enroll in these subjects and take it for credit, I just gave up. So I thought, you know, I'll get around to teaching it online at some point in the future, and, you know, what would change that way.
And did you have much to do in the, I guess, the setting of the standards? Because I'll give you a quick anecdote as well, because it's, I found I was doing lecturing for the SIA, and then that turned into FINSIA, and then FINSIA got bought by Kaplan, and it took me a little while to work out that I'd gone from working for an industry to having a second job. But it took, and then, but I found the standards as things went online dropped dramatically, and there was stuff where for me it was saying no, this the levels of people that should have passed because they turn up to a classroom every week and they'd sort of learn by osmosis, or I'm sitting here doing nothing, I'll have to pick it up, versus the online model where I suspect most of the students went, yeah, I'll do it next week. Geez, I've got to watch 10 hours worth of lectures all in a week before they do the exam. And the level really, really dropped. And I guess that's where I'm sort of, you know, my experience was saying, well, I sort of feel as if you almost need to go back to the classroom for some of these just to make sure you've actually got the involvement and you've got the buy-in from people.
Well, it doesn't have to be like that. And it's interesting you brought up FINSIA, because I actually, for fun, did a grad dip in applied finance at FINSIA, just on the side. And I found the quality actually of the course material was actually very, very, very good. And then it got acquired by Kaplan, and I actually quit, and I just did a Master of Applied Finance all over again at Macquarie for fun on the side, because I didn't want to do it with Kaplan. With the online method of education, I think there's many different models. I think one of the most effective models is probably the flipped classroom model, in a way, where you can the delivery of the course is done in an online fashion, but there is the tutors are there not to teach the material, or the lecturers are there not to teach the material, but to really help people progress through. So, for example, you know, using with analytics now with online education, you can see these people are going to make it, I'll leave them alone. These people are struggling, but will probably get there, so I'll leave them alone. These people are not going to make it, I can spend some time with them. And in fact, it's funny, I started doing F45, which is like this gym class. It's the same model. Like, in fact, the whole class is just run, the instructions of the gym class are run on screens, and the instructors don't run the class anymore. They just come around and kind of help you if you improve your technique. And I think, you know, it comes down to really the quality of the content that's written, and the quality of the assessment, and then kind of the interaction how interactive you have the engagement around the actual class. But I don't think necessarily it has to be a lower quality. I mean, certainly it's a lot easier to put education online, so you do get some lower quality courses, but I think it's still, you can actually get a far superior outcome. And the reason why it can be a superior outcome is because if you think about universities today, Statistics 101 is taught in every university in the world by different lecturers, different departments, different levels of quality, different curriculums, etc. You know, instead, you could find the best lecturer in the world to teach the best quality course that gets the best results, which you can measure analytically, then all these other people that are teaching it, you can free them up to teach the things they really want to teach, you know, in their field of expertise.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I'm certainly with you. There's obviously problems we still haven't solved in terms of getting that next stage, because I think, all the Harvard and all the Stanford stuff, or maybe till the Stanford courses are all online now, aren't they, for free?
Yeah.
And so me jumping on and reading a few of those isn't quite the same as going to Stanford, getting the degree and going through the extra process to, yeah. But and I suppose that also comes back to that whole point about education is saying, well, our current education system was set up 100 years ago, pre-computers and pre all this other stuff, and we just keep on churning out the same thing. And
well, we're training people to prepare for jobs that don't exist anymore.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think that's a key part of it, Matt, that the course curriculum needs to change, you know, on a dime, and, you know, having it online gives you the ability to do it, you know, on a weekly basis as need be. I guess the question for me actually was, as an employer, so you, I guess, obviously, you know, pushing the barrier now for an online sort of university style. If you sort of sat down in front of two graduates, one was, you know, from an Ivy League, for want of a better term, Melbourne, you know,
or Sandstone.
Yeah, Sandstone. Sorry, yeah, in Australia we call that a university, versus someone who's done something online. Perhaps even, it could be a US one. So you would see those guys in a similar light, you know, vis-a-vis same grades and all the rest of it.
It really does depend by institution. I have calibrated my rankings of institutions over time. But, you know, I've had people come apply for jobs who have come from overseas, for example, and they've said, they're putting their CV that they've done a bunch of courses on, Harvard X or MIT X or Stanford X or, Coursera or what have you. And when they've gone through and they've actually got the assessment, the key thing is the assessment, whether they've gone through the assessment and they've actually done well. I do actually rank that.
Okay.
So you mentioned robotics and AI, and we're training people for the disappearing jobs, the jobs of the past. What sort of future do you see for artificial intelligence and automation? I guess I'm thinking particularly in the services sectors that,
yeah,
you know, to date have been relatively quarantined from that movement, but seem to be sort of steadily being dragged in.
Any job that's described by an algorithm will go away, that can be described by an algorithm. It's happening first in white-collar jobs, but it will happen in blue-collar jobs. If you kind of see the stuff that Boston Dynamics is doing with robotics, and you know, there's some phenomenal videos on YouTube about applications like warehouses, pickers and packers and so forth. I think that one of the great social disruptions of our time, which is coming, is going to be through this. It's probably going to be the big impact is probably going to be in transportation, where if you think about the number of people who drive for a living, whether it's couriers, taxi drivers, bus drivers, truckers, and so forth. I think that we are not that far away. Maybe 10 years, but not that far away from a point where those jobs will just go wholesale and they'll be gone forever. There's no reason why someone should be driving a truck for 40 years, 8 to 12 hours a day or whatever the safety standards let you drive nowadays. It's a very unhealthy job. It's a very dangerous job, and it's a very inefficient job. And you can do it much better with software. And I think this will happen. It'll happen.
The software doesn't need amphetamines either.
Well, I think it will happen very quickly. I mean, you're obviously seeing all the things that Tesla's doing, and Tesla is kind of almost. I don't know if I wouldn't say it's kind of questionable how reckless they're being, I think, in terms of letting people using their self-driving features immediately. But it is not that far away from the point where the switch over will be, you will not be able to buy a car that's not self-driving. It will just happen that every manufacturer is just making self-driving cars. They'll do that, and it will start probably in a big way, I think, in like some of the professional driving industries, such as trucking and so forth, where they'll just say, for safety reasons and for efficiency reasons on highways, the only trucks that can operate are self-driving. And then what will happen very rapidly after that is the insurance companies will cotton on, and they will say, well, you want to drive your own car, do you? Well, that's especially unacceptable as smoking, right? If you want to drive your own car, let's pull up your driving record and compare it to the computer. And let me look at your driving record's worth the computer. Therefore, your premium is higher. And, the insurance companies will ensure that, it will just go full self-driving, and then people will go, okay, well, actually the experience is pretty good. I can actually go out and drink now and be picked up by a car and driven home from the pub, and I'd have to worry about drink driving. I can go Sydney to Melbourne and pop a sleeping tablet and wake up, and I'm in Melbourne. I can I can do my work in the back of my laptop on the way to work, rather than kind of worry about being in the front, keeping my eyes on the road, etc. So I think the switch is going to happen very, very quickly. Like that, I think you're all old enough to remember when mobile phones suddenly were everywhere, and you know, a year before they weren't. And the same thing will happen, I think, with self-driving cars probably in the next decade. But in terms of social impact, there's going to be a big dislocation because you'll have all these professional truck drivers, taxi drivers, courier drivers. I mean, the taxi drivers aren't even coping with the world of Uber, right? I mean, you look at the demographic of taxi drivers and the literacy levels and the and intelligence levels and the educational levels compared to Uber drivers, and there's a massive demographic shift there alone. And you're not going to retrain truck drivers to write software, let alone serve a coffee in a cafe.
I think from memory, there's about 250,000 drivers at risk in Australia, professional drivers. What about the sort of higher value add services, you know, the professions? Like I remember a few years ago, there was a lot of press around IBM's Dr. Watson and whatever, but some of those things seem to have gone a little more quiet. Does AI have a role in the future of those as well, do you think?
Yeah, certainly. Large parts of medical medicine as well as law are basically, humans are just expert systems. They go through years and years and years of training, reading medical books and reading you know, law books and the rules and regulations and so forth. And then they kind of have to come up with solutions based upon that, you know, diagnosis, for example, or you know, trying to craft a legal case. And those jobs will go wholesale in a big way, you know. And it's been starting for a while. It's been starting with outsourcing. So, you know, through the mid-2000s, you know, if you got an X-ray done at the hospital, chances are that the diagnosis was done by someone in India. And then ultimately, those jobs will be described by algorithms, and then they'll go, you know. And I think there will be a big change there. And then, of course, that will lead to better diagnosis. It will lead to probably better outcomes and less lawyers, which could always be a good thing.
But social disruption in the meantime.
Well, it doesn't have to be a bad thing, though. I mean, obviously what you're describing is a big productivity lift as well. So,
well, the thing about thing about this in the white collar world is that the people in the white collar world can retrain. It's a lot more flexible workforce to go on. You know, you used to be a doctor, you can now go to a startup, right? You start your own company, you can do whatever. It's a bit harder in the blue collar jobs if all you've done in your life is stack boxes or drive a truck to go, hey, you got to find a new job in the incredibly competitive technology savvy world of, you know, 2020, 2030.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's where policy has to play a role in some way in helping address and retrain. So I guess I'm conscious we're sort of approaching an hour here. I also want to just take you back a bit. You described, you know, you had seven offices around the world, pretty much covering all the major continents. What are you seeing in terms of business, like in terms of demand and you know, are you seeing, you described, you know, this wages boom in the US? Are you seeing that as a virtuous cycle, or does that look like it's topping out? How are you finding Europe? You know, how's Asia? Any trends that you know, that you can really kind of describe?
Yeah. So, well, on one level, the technology industry is fantastic because, as Marc Andreessen said, every industry is becoming a software industry, and software is eating the world. Like literally every business you know of is becoming a software business. You know, the biggest telephone company in the world is a software company. It's Skype. You know, the biggest bookstore in the world, biggest retailer in the world is a software company. It's Amazon. And it just goes industry by industry by industry. What happened, however, in the last two or three years is we're in a three-way trade war between Europe, the US and China. And, the regulation that has come into the technology industry is extreme. Apple gets fined 14 billion euros in Ireland, and then Deutsche Bank gets fined $14 billion for something by the US. And then you have the Europeans come out with GDPR, which is ostensibly to protect the privacy of consumers, but in real fact, it's to damage US technology companies. And try and get some sort of European technology industry going. Then you have VAT being launched by the Europeans in the country of purchase of a digital download. So if you're a French person on a train to Germany through Belgium, you've got to figure out which country is that person in order to levy the VAT rates. And there's like 24, I think, different VAT rates in Europe. you know, India has now come out with a law around GST. We now have someone who has to calculate for the, I believe it's 36 states of India, GST on a monthly basis and send returns, because you have to collect 1% GST. Then you've got the California Department of Business Oversight, who says, we think now that if you have an online marketplace and you make a payment in that online marketplace, that payment may look like actual money transmission or escrow. And as a result, we're going to regulate marketplaces like we regulate payment systems. And now, to the regulation for payment system, I actually own escrow.com, which is the world's oldest and largest online escrow company. We've done about $5.5 billion in payments through it, and it's for buying and selling airplanes, boats, cars, jewelry, gemstones, diamonds, what have you. To operate in the US, there are 50 states. It's state-by-state licensing. 4 states do not require licensing. There are 6 territories. So you need 52 financial services licenses to operate in the US, right? I have 46. So, yeah, I'm on my way. In every state, you have to be fingerprinted, palm-printed, arm-printed, balance sheet of assets, background checks. It's extreme. Some states require fingerprints on using ink on card. Some require you go to the US to get it done. It's just the amount of regulation is just extreme, and it's not going away. I mean, California is now coming with its own version of the GDPR, which is even more extreme, and so forth. China, you've got all the regulation about how you can run an internet company or not run an internet company. You know, I have a personal belief that Jack Ma sold out of Alibaba because he wants to. He just knows the regulations is going to come in. It's going to make it too hard for Alibaba to sell products into the US, et cetera. So, you know, it's just an incredibly challenging place, particularly because world leaders see technology as one of the limited places that there's growth happening in the world. And so that's a place for taxation revenue, and so they, you know, can be all.
And having said that, though, they haven't been very good at getting taxing a lot of these companies. So I guess they're finding it's easier to regulate than tax for some.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it all depends. I mean, companies like Google, for example, they employ people in Australia and they pay, you know, those people pay income taxes and so forth. But, you know, the problem is with this whole fair share taxation system, it's kind of like a modern world version of Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged. I mean, like, it's going to end up with, if you run a global technology company, by definition, anyone can just access your website anywhere in the world and buy something. I'll end up filing tax returns in 187 countries of the world, where the United Nations has recognized, and it's just a complete, the overhead to be able to do that is just extreme. So it's just,
whereas it'd make a lot more sense to have some sort of global regulator or tax thing who actually says, okay, well, we'll work it out, because otherwise you end up with a company saying, to the US government, oh, no, I'm going to pay taxes in Ireland. And the Irish company saying, no, I'm going to pay taxes in somewhere else. And, you know, the next thing you know, they're not paying taxes or not paying enough anywhere. Whereas if you've got one regulator that's looking at it, and it's much easier for the company, and then says splitting the proceeds.
Is that going to be United Nations?
we're nowhere near that, obviously. But, you know, but as you said, it sounds as if things are going to get a lot worse before they get better on that front.
What's the law of unintended consequences? I mean, the Australian government comes along and starts wanting to starts the paradigm of taxing in the country that you're selling the product. So, of course, everyone else will do that. And it turns out, well, Australia's a pretty small market. So Australian technology companies are going to lose as a result of pushing that paradigm, because, you know, we sell, you know, the whole point of building a technology company in Australia is to sell overseas. Mm. So, you know.
Yep.
So I'm taking from this that you're seeing very strong demand, basically, for, as you say, software is eating the world. So you're not finding any demand problems anywhere in various parts of the globe, like slowing or speeding up or anything. Just
I'm in the broad categories. I provide freelancer.com is a global marketplace for jobs, and 33 million people in that marketplace. We've done 15 million jobs today at projects. So build me a website, design me a logo, whatever it may be, financial research, copywriting, you name it. We've got a payments business being escrow for anything that's expensive or complicated. And then we have a freight marketplace called Freightlancer. So we're in the very broad categories of labor, payments, and freight, which really help entrepreneurs and commerce, you know, transact and interact around the world.
Okay, sure thing. Well, I normally use this time just to sort of wrap up and give you a chance to plug your various business interests, but I feel like you've just done that then, Matt. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Is there some ways that our listeners can get in touch with you, or anything else you'd like to pop in?
Sure. I guess you haven't read my article, it's on Medium. Just search for Matt Barry, Barrie. I also publish things on LinkedIn occasionally. You can find me on LinkedIn. But enjoyed very much the conversation with everyone today, and obviously an avid reader of Macro Business. I think in my House of Cards article, I used a bunch of images and a bunch of quotes from various articles over the years. So I very much appreciate it.
You did. That's okay, though, because I think we plagiarized your entire article in return. So
I'm happy with that.
Very good. Well, look, thanks again for your time today, Matt. It was fantastic. Great insights there, and we really look forward to getting you on the show sometime soon, mate. So, yeah, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers. So, Damien, 50-odd minutes spent there with Matt Barry, a very smart guy, entrepreneur, and had plenty of insight on the Australian economy and where he thinks we're headed. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think there's a couple of key things I brought out. There's obviously a lot we spoke about innovation and education and things like that. I think the key one for me is that it comes down to this core thesis we have, is that the Australian economy has been through this massive expansion based on the growth in resources. And that then, as that boom sort of tailed off, the RBA cut rates and the APRA loosened up on lending standards, and we basically blew this big housing bubble. So we took, and Matt's pretty much on that same sort of path. And so the question now is, so the resources boom's coming to an end, the housing boom's coming to an end or over. The question is, what replaces these in terms of the Australian economy? What's actually going to drive it going forward? And we've had the view for a while that it does need to be this whole manufacturing, IT, innovation, a modern economy. Move your economy into a modern economy, not one that basically just digs dirt and sells it and flogs houses to each other. Mm. As we heard though, there's no quick fixes. That's not something you can just you have your innovation statement by your then prime minister who says we're going to throw all this money at the problem and everything will be fixed. And and here we are 2 or 3 years later, and said one of our leading tech entrepreneurs isn't quite sure whether there is an innovation minister or not.
Yeah.
At the moment. So
and also feels like the solution starts at primary school level, which is it's a pretty long lead time.
Exactly. So that all comes back to saying we need a lower dollar. And that's that's your solution in the end, is saying, well, if you drive the Australian dollar down to a level where as Matt said, if you're starting the business again, he wouldn't be starting it in Australia for a number of reasons. But if you get the Australian dollar low enough, people will. We do have an educated workforce, and although there are problems, that we ran through, well educated, good rule of law, relatively low on, good on corruption, in a relative sense. And so the idea is that, from our perspective, is to fix this, you either go through this long period of stagnation, or the Aussie dollar falls quite rapidly, and you get the chance to regrow and rebuild some of these sectors that left Australia when the Australian dollar was so high.
Yep.
To stop the resources boom.
Yep.
And so it keeps coming back to that same. We keep circling back to that same sort of thoughts. Is that that's the way you need to be positioning your portfolio for the longer term, is position it for a lower dollar, position it for either stagnation or a recession in Australian economy before you can get your lift back.
Mm. And so practically, how's that sort of play out in our portfolios?
So minimum weight Aussie equities, basically. Mm. So, and as we spoke a little bit about it then with Matt, but the problem very much in the large cap Australian equities is your choices are resources, banks, property related stocks. And now once you've done those, there isn't much left.
Mm.
And the ones that are left are often ones like, as you said, technology stocks are actually quite well priced in Australian markets. There's not many in the large cap space, but the ones that are, CSL, ResMed, Cochlear, for example, CSL Cochlear, sorry, in the large cap space, are a lot more expensive than what you see a lot of their overseas competitors. Like there's some of these things you're paying 30 times earnings to get a seat at the table.
Mm.
And so the question comes back to those ones. Look, great businesses, love them at the right prices, more than happy to own them. But do I want to own them at 35, 40 times and without a sort of clear view to the next leg of growth and things like that? Saying, well, that's a, in our portfolios, we're tending to find stocks elsewhere.
Yep.
And as the world gets more globalized, I think that's, it becomes less of a, you get less of risk there. And you also do get the extra benefit of if the Aussie dollar falls, that you pick up the gains on currencies as well.
Okay, sure thing. All right, very good. And on that note, well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.